He's there in the book of Revelation. We're told that he's seeing all these signs and these witnessing these great events. And I believe in Revelation chapter 9, what we see is the consequence of sin. We see some of the ugliness of sin. Before we actually begin in chapter 9, I want to give you a little background on what's happening in chapter 9. In chapters 5 and 6, there were some trumpets that were blown. And we're only going to look at the fifth trumpet today. There's seven trumpets total. Chapters 5 and 6, you see the first four. Chapter 9, you see 5th and 6th, but we're only going to look at the 5th today. So the first four were blown in chapter 8 and revealed sin's impact on the world. I said that wrong. Okay, and revealed sin's impact on the world. And we're going to see here that the trumpets in this chapter, the first trumpet 5, will demonstrate sin's impact on the sinner. When we're not going to look at trumpet 6, will show the impact of sin upon other people. Before we actually begin, I want to just make this statement. When you're reading through the book of Revelation, there's a lot of details. And as you read through it, notice the details, but don't lose sight of the big picture. You know, we've all heard of that phrase, you can't see the forest through the trees. That's kind of what I don't want you to do here. Jim McGuigan made this comment on this passage. People often see brush strokes when they ought to see portraits. And we're going to look at the brush strokes a little bit, but what I want to do is focus on the portrait. Let's focus on the big picture and what's happening here. I want to talk for a brief moment about what is our view of sin in our society. How does our society look at sin? What do we think of sin? Well, it's so interesting because we just had the Hot Topic seminar. One of the subjects was the subject on homosexuality and marriage. Well, we don't call it homosexuality in our society anymore. We call it an alternate lifestyle. We don't call abortion killing of children. We call it the freedom to choose. We make sin a lot more palatable. We take away the nasty names that the Bible calls it. We take away the nasty names that reveal the horribleness of sin. And we make it something not as bad. We call it an illness, or it's a vice, or it's a problem I have. But we don't call it for what it is. It's sin. And I personally think part of the problem in our country and in our church is that we don't call things for how they are. We don't call things as bluntly as the Bible does. On Tuesday, we had the open Bible study at Mildred's house. And we were talking about Isaiah chapter 1. In Isaiah chapter 1, God calls the nation of Judah sodomites. That gets your attention. See, God got people's attentions. He didn't call them people who are practicing alternate lifestyles. He didn't call them that. He called them sodomites. He called them for what they are. We talked in that Bible study a little bit about what Jesus called the Jews. When he comes in, he has the seven woes, and he's talking to the Pharisees and the scribes, and he says, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites." And he calls them whitewashed tombs. He calls them brood of vipers. God calls sin for what it is. When God is dealing with sin, He lets it known this is an ugly, nasty thing. But too much in our society, we make it seem very palatable, watered down, not that bad. You know, we take away the consequences of sin if we make sin seem like it's not a big deal. If I call sin an alternate lifestyle, is there really going to be a huge punishment for choosing an alternate lifestyle? But if I call it an abomination, as Leviticus 18 does, then maybe we can see that there's going to be horrible consequences to this abomination. Part of the thing we're going to see here in this passage is it's going to reveal, I think, the consequences of sin in a shocking manner. It's not going to make it look pretty. It's going to make sin look like a rotten corpse, not an ill child. It's going to make it look horrible. It's going to paint an ugly picture. And sometimes we need that picture painted. Sometimes we need to recognize sin for what it is. It's death. Romans 6:23. So this chapter focuses on the wages of sin. In biblical imagery, we see the consequences of sin. As we go through this chapter, let's focus on two things. Focus on who these things are happening to and why are they happening to them. Let's go ahead and begin in Revelation chapter 9, verse 1. And the fifth angel blew his trumpet. And I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. Now, there's a lot of people who want to talk about who the star is. Is it Satan? Is it an evil spirit? Is it an evil demon? It doesn't really matter who the star is. Personally, it could be just an angel of God. Now, that might be shocking and frightening. Oh, how could God make an angel do all these horrible things? But we have to remember, in the book of Exodus, God sent an angel to wipe out the firstborn son, didn't he? Hasn't God used angelic beings to do punishing acts in the past? I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying it could be. And really the point is not who the star is, but what he does. So we see a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. Regardless of who the star is, the point is he's a tool of God. And it says that he is given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. So he didn't have the key until it was given to him. You see, God is the one who controls all things. This angel of the bottomless pit didn't have the key already. It wasn't in his possession. It was given to him by God. Again, one of the points you're going to notice in this passage is God is in control. And the bottomless pit, literally it's the abyss. The King James Version translated it, the bottomless pit, and most versions follow that. But it's the abyss. And what does that mean? Well, it's kind of difficult to put it exactly in terms that we can perhaps understand. It used to mean the deep parts of the ocean, but what does it mean when you're reading it in the Bible? Well, it seems to be just a symbolic place for the dwelling of evil and torment. David Roper made this comment: "The imagery is symbolic to convey the terrible nature and far-reaching effects of sin. Bottomless pit, a place without end, a place that is deep. Sin is far-reaching, even to the bottom, the deep, the depths of the ocean. To the bottom of this pit, sin has far-reaching consequences." Let's pick up in verse 2. The angel, the star here, he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit. And from the shaft rose smoke, like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from this shaft. This is a scary scene. Again, let this be a picture in your mind. You're John, and you witness what appears to be a star falling from heaven, and he's given the key to this bottomless pit. And I imagine that this bottomless pit looks scary. I don't think it has roses planted around it. I think this is dark and dismal and frightening stuff here. And I think that as John is witnessing these things, I think he's a little scared. I think he's a little terrified of what's going on here. And this is like a nightmare scene. So he comes and he opens the bottomless pit. When I was a kid, my dad used to always like to tell stories. And he's a much better storyteller than I am. And so he used to like to tell stories. And one story he told us as kids was a story he made up called Joe and the Hole in the Rock. That story scared me to death. I remember I'd be real little. I was the youngest of the four boys. My older brother, Roland, is about 5 years older than me. So we'd lay in bed, and he'd have two boys on each arm as we lay in bed. He'd tell the story, and he'd start it off eerily. He'd be quiet, and all of a sudden he'd go, "Whoa!" He'd say, "That's how it began." And we'd say, "Dad, don't do that." And he'd just laugh. Ha, ha, ha. He thought it was funny. But then the story he tells is a story of Joe who doesn't want to be a part of God's family. And he walks you through the story to the point that Joe is looking for the source of these screams. He's looking, where are these screams coming from? So he goes and he sits down on a rock in the middle of the night looking for these screams. Where are they coming from? And he looks beside him in the rock, and there's a hole in the rock. That's why he calls it Joe and the Hole in the Rock. And he looks down inside, and what he can see is literally into hell. And he can see the people in torment. He can see the things they're going through. And they tell him, "Joe, don't come here." That is how I view this. It's eerie. It's frightening. He opens up this pit, and I think you hear screams. I think you hear screams of torment. I think you hear things that are frightening and terrible and horrible. And he sees these things. He's watching these things. And from the shaft, as if it's not scary enough, he hears these screams. Then this dark smoke starts billowing out. When I was at San Jose State, I used to drive back and forth a lot, commuting home. And it's about a two-hour drive. And I drive through a little town called Wesley. I'm sure most of you have never heard of Wesley, California. But I drive through little Wesley, California. And one time when I was driving back through there, there was smoke. It was so dark, so black, it literally darkened the sky for miles and miles. It was like riding into nighttime. And it was spooky. Well, what had happened was there was a big tire, a dump site. Huge tire dump site. And this thing had caught on fire. And it literally burned for weeks. They couldn't get it out. The smoke with the fire was so hot they couldn't get close enough to it. It would not go out. And the smoke filled the air for miles and miles, and it was frightening. It was scary. John says here, the smoke came out of this pit. And it says it darkened the sky. And I just want to point this out. This is what sin is. Sin is like this smoke. It blackens the sky. You know, if God is the light, and we're told that He is, and in Him is no darkness, sin is the separation of God. Sin is the darkness. It's the blackness. And we have here the smoke coming up, and it's blocking us from God. It's blocking them from God. They can't see Him anymore. They can't have His light anymore. And that's a frightening thing. I mean, how horrible it is to not have God in your life. And so sin does that. Sin blocks us from Him. And the sun here was blackened by the cloud, by the smoke. It's also been suggested that the smoke here represents the blinding that Satan does to us. You know, we're told in a number of passages that Satan blinds us. And so it's been suggested that that's what's happening here. Satan is blinding the mind of the unbelievers. I want to read to you two passages, one from 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4. Paul wrote, In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Paul said Satan blinds the minds so that they can't see the light from the light of God, so they can't hear the gospel. Perhaps that's what's happening here. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 12, Paul wrote this, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son. So it may represent the fact that Satan is busy, involved in blinding those who want to hear the gospel, those who might hear the gospel. It's also been suggested that this is a punishment for sin, which I think perhaps is a little bit of all these things. I don't know that you can separate all of them. But that perhaps it's a punishment for sin. God allowing people to suffer, to live in darkness, not because He wants them to live in darkness, but actually just for the opposite. He loves them, and if you love somebody, sometimes you let them have the natural consequence of their actions. Sin, separation from God, is a natural consequence to sin. When you sin, you're separated from God. You live in darkness. It can't help but remind me of the whole image in the book of Exodus, in the plagues. And again, Revelation is a book that you need to know the Old Testament to understand. It has so much Old Testament in it. Here they are living in darkness, a punishment of God. And I want to read to you a quote. It is the smoke of deception and delusion, of sin and sorrow, of moral darkness and delusion. I'm going to read it one more time. It is the smoke of deception and delusion, of sin and sorrow, of moral darkness and delusion. That's from William Hendrickson. Alfred Plummer wrote this. It is perhaps best to regard the smoke as the evil influence of the devil, which darkens men's understandings. The point is this darkness, this smoke, is something evil, either separating us from God or demonstrating the consequence of sin, that we are now living in darkness. You'll also note in that passage, go back to Revelation chapter 9, you'll also notice in verse 2 it says, He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the smoke arose like a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. So the sun was darkened, but John also said that the air was darkened. Now what does that mean? Well, I'm going to tell you Nathan's understanding of this passage. You ever suffocated? You ever started to suffocate? You ever been in the bottom of a pool and you couldn't get up? I remember going going abalone diving with a friend of mine from California. And it was a lot of fun, but it was kind of terrifying at times. You know, we'd go into Northern California in April, and the water is frigid. And they give you these supposedly wetsuits to keep you warm. I don't understand that whole theory. Here, fill it with cold water so you stay warm. But that's the theory behind it. Doesn't work. I was freezing. Anyway, so I'm in this freezing cold water, and it's stressful. First of all, they tell us, well, there was this many shark attacks in this area last year, and what they eat, what they feed on seals, and here there's seals swimming all around us. And I'm like, man, I look just like a seal, a big fat one, but a seal. And I'm floating in this water, and I'm terrified. And then my friend, you know, he'll disappear. This guy holds his breath amazing length of time. He would disappear, and I would go down, I'd come back up, and I still haven't seen him. He could hold his breath for 4 minutes. And it was amazing to me how long he could hold his breath. And it was terrifying to me, in this water, you go down in the water, and there's seaweed down there. And I can't help but panic. I can't help but think, man, I got to get up. I got to have some air. Because you see, sin is just like that. Sin is suffocating. Sin is frightening. We know how much we need air. We know how frightening it is to not have air. I wouldn't stay down for as long as I could hold my breath normally because I was just petrified of what was in that water with me. Seaweed and seals and sharks and who knows. But the real fear for me was getting air. I had to get air. And that's how sin is. It says that the black smoke darkened the air. I can't help but get a feeling of suffocation when I read that. And sin is just that way. Sin is suffocating. Sin, when you're starting to not be able to breathe, you panic. It's terrifying. You feel like you're absolutely helpless. I've also been really bad, especially when I was younger, at swallowing things too big as a way of not eating my vegetables. I'd swallow them whole. Don't do that. Two times I had the Heimlich maneuver done on me as a kid. You know, but I remember one time in particular, my dad was making me potatoes, and I didn't like potatoes at the time. They were big chunk potatoes. And I was trying to get by from chewing them up. I dipped them in ketchup, put it in my mouth, chased it with root beer. Well, that potato I didn't chew got stuck in my throat. Due to ketchup, root beer, it's not going down. Root beer and ketchup are flowing out of my mouth. And I start panicking. I start running around in a circle, not knowing what to do. My dad says, Ace, come here. So I ran over to him, and he did the Heimlich maneuver, and I was able to breathe and stuff. But suffocating is so frightening. Sin is the same way. He says here that the air was darkened. The Hebrew writer describes sin in this way, in Hebrews chapter 12, as something that clings so closely. It entangles us. Just like that seaweed when I was talking about swimming in that. It entangled me. It was terrifying to me. It wouldn't let me get up. And I hated it. Sin is that way. It's terrifying. It's overwhelming. John is describing a scene here that I think it's absolutely terrifying. It's dark. It blocks us from the sun. It's not allowing us to breathe. And smoke does those things. Let's pick up in verse 3. As if the smoke wasn't bad enough, look at what happens next. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. Now, we don't really understand how scary locusts are. We don't have an impact of how horrible this thing is. If you read the book of Joel, you get a good picture of how terrifying locusts are. The book of Joel is a book that says that they were talking about the invasion of these locusts. And also, if you want to talk about locusts, you can go to the plagues of Egypt and see locusts. I want to read to you a little bit from an article. I've kind of adapted it a little bit, but it was written in 1915 and was published in National Geographic by a guy named John D. Whiting. He was talking about a locust plague that hit Palestine in 1915. In 1915, the first swarms of adult locusts appeared in March, coming from the northeast, going south, in such thick clouds as to obscure the sun for the time being. The females, about 2.5 to 3 inches long, at once began to lay their eggs, sinking a hole about 4 inches deep to lay their eggs, and depositing about 100 eggs in each hole. It is estimated by competent authorities that as many as 65,000 to 75,000 locust eggs are concentrated in a square meter of soil. In a meter of square meter of soil, 65,000 to 75,000 locust eggs will be deposited. That's an amazing number. He continued, in 1915, the fully developed flying locusts appeared about June 10th and at once began to complete the destruction begun in the earlier stages. They attacked the olive trees, whose tough, bitter leaves had not been the liking of the creepers. Food becoming scarcer, both creeping and flying locusts attacked the olive trees, and between the two, they stripped every leaf, berry, and even the tender bark. Likewise, every variety of tree was attacked. Of the cacti, they ate away layer after layer of the whole surface, giving the leaves the effect of having been jackplaned. The full-grown locust had cleaned every bit of vegetation. That's from 1915. Now listen to this from the year 2000. Even in the year 2000 AD, scientists tell us if the locusts are not destroyed or contained shortly after they hatch, and once the swarm has performed, control effects are minimal. There's no way of controlling them, is what they say, if they hatched. Or at least there's not a very good way of controlling them. He continued, plagues continue as long as climatic conditions favor the large hatches. One such swarm, listen to this, one such swarm reached across the Red Sea and was estimated to have covered 2,000 square miles. That will darken the sun. 2,000 square miles. They continued, a swarm can contain up to 120 million per mile. 120 million locusts per mile, and you have these spread out 2,000 square miles. I did a little figuring here, taking the conservative number, 2.5 billion locusts might be involved in a plague of this magnitude. 2.5 billion. David Roper made this comment: there was no more chilling announcement in the ancient world than the locusts are coming. We don't understand how terrible it is. We don't have huge locust problems. We see a locust, we step on it. No big deal. We don't have swarms like they do. They still have them. This is so scary, so terrifying. It says these plague, but these locusts here, let's back up. These were not even normal locusts, were they? It says they have the ability to sting in their tail like scorpions do. Skip down to verse 7. And we're going to look some more about these locusts. Beginning of verse 7. In appearance, the locusts were like. Now notice these things were like. It doesn't say these things were this, but simply that they resembled this. John is trying to describe, to the best of his ability, what these things looked like. This was a picture. He's trying to describe it. He's using words that we understand. He's not saying they were this, simply they looked like this. He says, in appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. Horses were aggressive. Battle horses were aggressive, fierce animals. I think that's what he's getting at here. These things were fierce. In addition to that, some say that the horse head resembles a locust head. And in fact, locusts are sometimes called small horses or miniature horses in some different languages. But I think what he's getting at here is the fierceness of the battle horse. He continued, on their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. The word there for crowns here is the victory crown. It's not. He's talking about these appeared to have a victory crown on their heads. To me, what does that mean? Maybe it means that they're confident that they're going to do the task they're set out for. So they're aggressive, they're confident. And he continues, and their faces were human faces. Now that's frightening. You see these locusts, they come and they have tails like scorpions. They appear aggressive like a horse, but they have a face like a human. And humans are known for their intelligence, supposedly. So these were intelligent appearing creatures. And it says in verse 8, their hair like women's hair. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing to me. I read a couple different commentaries, and some were saying that it had something attractive about it. I don't think that's what he's getting at. To me, if I put long hair, beautiful long hair, on a bearded man, it's ugly. It's freaky. You're like, ugh, that's not nice. And when I see nice, beautiful long hair on frightening locusts, I don't think it's beautiful. I think it's frightening. I think it's scary. So these were like, they had long hair, like women's hair. And their teeth were like lion's teeth. They were fierce. Verse 9, they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails and sting like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. These locusts are not normal. So you see this angel, this star falling from heaven. He opens this pit, and smoke, thick black smoke, billows out. And there's screams and there's sounds of torment. And then from this come these locusts that are scary, frightening in appearance, terrifying. And what are they going to do? Let's back up to verse 4. And they were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. One thing that's worth noting here and very important in this passage, especially to the first century Christians, is this. God is in control. God is in control. It says they were told not to harm the grass, the trees. So God is in control. What they would normally have eaten, what they would normally have attacked, what they normally would have consumed, they were told by God, don't touch this time. I want to read to you a quote. It's a little lengthy, but please bear with me. This is from David Roper, who actually adapted it from another man, but please bear with me as I read this. Without warning, a hole opens up at your feet, and dirty black smoke billows forth, blotting out the sun and filling your world with gloom. You hear a whirring, a buzzing that increases in intensity until you think your eardrums will burst. Suddenly you are surrounded by creatures from your darkest nightmare, demonic creatures darting through the air. They resemble gigantic locusts, but unlike any locust you have ever seen. They are armed like scorpions, shaped like horses, crowned like kings. They have the faces of men, the hair of women, and the teeth of lions. They are armor-plated and winged, and they move with deafening noise. More disturbing is the fact that they ignore the lush vegetation in the area and keep moving closer to you. That's frightening. On their human-like faces is an expression of unholy glee. Soon they surround you, plunging their stingers into your arms, your hands, your legs, your feet, your head, your face. You collapse beneath the weight of the squirming, torturing bodies. As you lie writhing upon the ground, your body consumed by burning pain, the words, half remembered, flicker through your thoughts. The wages of sin is death. Is that a scary picture? I think he paints that so well. It's terrifying. He says, on their faces, human faces are expressions of unholy glee. Nothing to me scares me more than that phrase, that statement. That sticks with me. He says, as this person in this retelling of this passage lays there writhing in pain, it says, the words half remembered flickers through his thoughts. The wages of sin is death. Again, I believe this to be visually demonstrating the consequences of sin. Consequences of not being a part of God. Let's continue with this. The locusts were sent by God, but not because he hated the people. The locusts were sent in the book of Joel. He didn't send the locusts because he hated Judah. He sent the locusts for just the opposite reason. He sent the locusts because he loved Judah. He sent the locusts because he wanted to wake the people up, to say, return to me. You're living in sin. Stop living in sin. Come and be a part of God. Come and be a part of me. And also notice this. God's people here are under protection. That's a very important note. Again, remember the Christians in the first century. This was written for them, especially for them. They were going through very difficult times. They needed to be reminded. They needed to remember that God's in control and you're under His protection. Notice again what it says in verse 4. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. This punishment is for those who do not have God. In the book of Exodus, the locusts were not in the land where the Israelites were. The locusts were only in the land where the Egyptians dwelt. This locust, in the same way, is under God's control. Only those to whom do not have God in their life was this punishment sent. And in fact, in Revelation chapter 7, verse 3, we're not going to turn back there, but I'll read it to you. It says, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of God on their foreheads." God seals His servants. God protects His servants. It says here that only those who do not have the seal of God were going to be tortured. We're going to be punished. And again, this is a chastisement for sin, a visual demonstration, if you will. Let's pick up in verse 5. It says, "They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them." There's a couple of things I want to point out from these verses. First of all, God limited the punishment. I already mentioned that, but look at this again. God placed boundaries on them. They were limited in time. They could only do this for 5 months. There was a time limit. They were limited in degree. They could injure, but not kill. Now, that will change. In fact, the very next trumpet, the sixth trumpet, you see that change. But they were limited in time. They were limited in degree, and they were limited in scope. Only those who do not have God's seal were going to be punished. So God is in control. God is limiting the punishment. He is the one who is controlling everything. You know, that's one of the messages Nebuchadnezzar had to learn in the book of Daniel. That God rules in the hearts, in the kingdoms of men. And God is ruling here in Rome in the first century as well. In verse 6, you see here the punishment is so bad, the torture is so bad, that people are seeking death. They're seeking to die. But again, if this is a consequence of sin, is death going to bring relief? If you die in your sin, is that going to bring relief? Remember the rich man and Lazarus? The rich man was taken to hell, wasn't he? He was taken to punishment. Death did not bring anything good for him. If you die in your sin, if you die in your punishment, death is not a release. If you die in your sin, Death is not an escape. It is to those who are Christians. It is to those who have been sealed by God. But it is not for those who have not been sealed by God. They mistakenly thought, if I could only die, my punishment would end. They're wrong in that. Their punishment would have just began. But that's how bad the torture was. Please just take me. Please let me die. But there is no relief apart from God. Sin offers no mercy. Satan, no forgiveness. There is no escape. There is no relief apart from God. That is a message, a lesson that I think verse 6 is demonstrating to us. Let's skip down to verse 11 because we've read 7 through 10. And verse 11 says, they have as king over them, talking about the locusts, have as king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is Apollyon. So these two words pretty much mean the same thing. Destroyer, destruction, the destroying one. And verse 12 says, the first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. We're not going to talk about the other woes today. I want to end with a couple of brief things. What lessons were there in this for the first century Christians? Again, if this is written to them, to encourage them, to strengthen them, what could they get from this that would benefit them as Christians? First of all, something I've already hammered home, God's in control. He's the one behind the scenes. He's the one who limits the punishment. He's the one who controls the scene. He's the one who places the boundaries. We also see from this that God answers prayers. In Revelation chapter 6, verse 9 through 11, you see those who were killed for the cause of Christ. And they're underneath the altar, the place of worship. And they're praying to God, saying, God, how long till you revenge us? How long till you avenge us? How long till you punish those who did this to us? I think here we see an answer to that prayer. I think here we see a fulfillment, a completion of that. So one of the messages for them is God answers prayers. God's hearing your cries. Another one is this. It's a call to remain faithful. That's really what the book of Revelation is. It's a book saying, don't give up. God overcomes the world. And I think He is calling them to remain faithful, to not quit. You may go through hard times. You may go through tortures. But this is what's going to happen to those who are apart from God in the end. So don't give up. But what lesson do we get from this as Christians today? I think there's a number of lessons for us. First of all, sin blinds us. Sin keeps us from seeing God. Sin suffocates us. It entangles us in it. How many people have told a lie to get out of something, then had to tell another lie and another lie? And pretty much you have a web of lies. Because that's how sin is. It's entangling. It's like a net thrown upon you. It encompasses you. Another lesson I think we can learn from this is that sin torments. If you think about sin, you can think about how it affects you in your life. Sin brings shame. The shame, the guilt of the sin. It can bring physical pain. You can actually have physical pain because of your spiritual sin, because of the sin in your life. You can have sorrow. You can live in fear of what might happen because of the fact you have sin in your life. But these things I mentioned, they can either be a curse or a blessing. The Apostle Paul said, godly sorrow leads to repentance. If we let these negative consequences of sin, if we let them impact us, then they can bring us back to God. But if we don't, then we can be lost forever. I want to read to you one more verse from Revelation 9. Look at beginning of verse 20 of Revelation 9. The rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues, look at those next three words, did not repent. These things, what we would say are horrible punishments, these things are in the book of Revelation, they're there for a reason. To wake us up to say, God loves you. Not because God hates us. He punishes us because He loves us. I punish my children because I love them. God is saying, please stop your lives of sin. He's also reassuring the Christians in the first century, I'm going to punish those who don't come to me. So I think one of the things we can see is the torment of sin. Another lesson I think is the vileness of sin and the horror of its consequences. And the final point is this, that there is no relief or escape apart from God. I want to read to you from 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. It says, my little children, I am writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He is the propitiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. We struggle with sins in our life. Sins affect us, sins grab us, sins torment us. They entangle us in their web, and there is no relief for that apart from God. John said in 1 John chapter 2 that we have a relief. It's Jesus Christ, our advocate, the one who stands in that courtroom on our behalf, who pleads our case. Guys, if you have sins in your life, God wants to forgive them. He doesn't want to punish you. He doesn't want to torture you. He wants to forgive you. And there's no better thing than that. If you're here this morning and you have sins in your life that you need forgiveness for, if you're struggling with sins, we would like to help you with that. If you have not been baptized and would like to be put Christ on in baptism, become a part of His family, we can help you with that as well. If you have any needs we can be of assistance with, please come as we sing a song that's been selected.